Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Another Breakfast.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is documentary producer Charlie Phillips. Welcome to the show.
Hello, nice to be here.
Indeed, indeed. Not only are you a documentary producer, you're also head of stories at Lifter, a platform created to support teachers in tackling complex themes and topics. And you're a programmer at Folkestone Documentary Film Festival as well.
That's right. Yeah, I do multiple different jobs because that's the life of the freelancer. So I like to say that I'm a documentary producer because that is the thing that I spend most of my time doing, trying to get funding for the documentaries I'm producing and trying to help them get to the right place creatively. Such is the state of the documentary industry that that's not necessarily the thing that brings in the most money for me. So, and I'm also quite a restless person as well. So I like to be doing multiple different things at once. And that's where the documentary festival here in Folkestone, where I live, comes in, which I program, and I'm also the artistic director for, which basically means that I program the films. It's quite a grand title. And then also do Lifter, which is an educational platform that brings documentaries to kids. And yeah, I just love documentaries, so I try and approach it from as many different aspects as possible in my life.
Okay, well let's start at the beginning then of a process of documentary. I mean, I'm a screenwriter, so I know how a scripted film starts in terms of someone's got to either have some intellectual property or create intellectual property. You can then turn into a screenplay that can be produced into a film, and depending on the whys and wherefores of what you write, will attract or not attract a certain level of money in the market or none at all. So when you're looking at the marketplace or looking at filmmakers to work with, what kind of documentary are you looking to make? Because obviously while they can be cheaper to shoot, they can often take longer to shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I've always worked in documentaries. Prior to what I'm doing now, I was a commissioner of short documentaries, and I've also worked at documentary festivals. So I have seen a lot of documentaries and I'm quite precise in what I like, which is the observational documentary. So I really love films where you're going to see a story unfolding in front of you without too much intervention from a filmmaker. So the style of the directors I like to work with is generally that they're a verite filmmaker, so they like to go and they like things to unravel in front of them. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a fly on the wall, because that's just not a thing that really exists in life. Like, a director has an impact on the people in their films. But generally, I love to work with directors who have a very relaxed relationship with their people on screen, so they feel relaxed enough to just open up about their lives and just do the things that they're going to do. So from a style point of view, that's very much what I look for. But I also really love to work with like visionary documentary makers who come with a very particular style. So one of the directors I'm working with, Jeannie Finlay, we're doing a film about the northeast of England. And she has, I think this is her, I think it's her 9th feature doc, might even be more than that, but she's made a lot of feature docs. And in all of her films, there's a very kind of glossy, creative approach. She's very empathetic towards her contributors, but there's always this very lush visual feeling in what she does. She's very good at using natural elements in her films. There's a really great use of color. So she's got a very definite creative approach where you can tell what a Jeanie Finlay film looks like. Another of the directors I'm working with, Jesse Gutch, who is making a film about Folkestone, where I live. She always brings a kind of hybrid approach. So she does beautiful observational work, but she's also great at making constructed scenes that are on the borderline of documentary and drama, because she's also a drama filmmaker. And so I look for those really exciting creative approaches, as well as a subject that I'm really interested in. Yeah. It's important to me to be working in a subject that I care about and that I think is going to make a difference to people's lives. So it's a lot of different things, but so much of it is just led by wanting to work with directors that I think are really cool.
One of the things there about that idea of observational, again, because it's unscripted, it's all very well to be relaxed and observant, but then how the hell can you have any confidence you'll ever have a film? You know, we could observe lots of things, but it won't create a narrative. So how does the planning of a documentary give you confidence? I mean, obviously, a track record like Jenny's got, it's not a question of her talent. It's more like I'm trying to get into the head of, like, when you go into producing a documentary, how can you be confident there's a story going to emerge?
Yeah, it is a gamble.
Okay.
Because you get really excited about a story and you have this sense of how the story could unfold on screen and speak to the director a lot about what is likely to happen, what the contributors have told you, where this could take you. You write, you know, reams and reams of material for a funding application about what the end point of the film is going to be. But you really don't know. I mean, everything could go wrong. The story could go away. The character could turn out to not be as engaging as you thought they might be. I mean, there is risk, but with experience, you learn that if a character is being honest with you and they've let you into their life, they are telling you what is likely to happen in their life, you have a rapport with them where they're going to give you a heads up when something interesting is going on, then you tend to get that really interesting material that you can weave into a film.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't really get involved in a story if I didn't think there was an actual story there, if I didn't think there was going to be an endpoint that was going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I'm really into story-based filmmaking. I mean, that said, the Folkestone film that I'm doing, it does have stories in it, but it's quite a concept-led film. It's a film, it's called Border Town. It's about the idea of the borders that we create around our identities, as well as the physical border in Folkestone on the English Channel.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting one, because I really love that kind of filmmaking as well, where you come with quite a concept-led approach. And with that film, we've sort of cast different characters around town who have their own interesting mini stories that we're going to follow. But the whole of the film is going to be quite concept-led. And when you're making that sort of film, because you're sort of creating the idea that the stories are fitting into, you can be a lot more confident that you're going to be able to put something together that is going to work as a coherent piece of filmmaking. Actually, that kind of filmmaking and that kind of producing is a bit more like fiction producing. Not that I've ever done that, but it is more like fiction producing or fiction screenwriting, because you're being more constructed in how you fit the different pieces together.
Yeah. I mean, I know from people who've pitched sort of documentary TV stuff, you know, you kind of Sunderland Till I Die and things like that, where as part of the pitch, you kind of create a fictional narrative of a character that exists, but you don't know that's from a character, to give the people you are commissioning this kind of thing an idea of where it could go. So it'd be like, you know, Phyllis is a cleaner. She's been at the club for 50 years, you know. You can create a picture for people that they can run away with without you needing to film that, but you can, but you might not get that when you make the film. I mean, it's not guaranteed.
Yeah, you might not get exactly that, but you'll get something that sort of fills that gap. And so, like with Border Town, we've got like six main characters and then about six sort of secondary characters. And we spoke to about 50 different people around town. And it wasn't as cynical as this, but we were sort of going, you know, we really want someone who's representing the queer scene. We really want a politician. We really want a fisherman. You know, we want these like different kinds of people. Yeah. And as long as you know, you're going to get someone who represents a particular worldview and is doing a particularly interesting set of things, then you really want that first person that you've spoken to. But if you didn't get that person, you got someone else who fills that particular gap, then with that kind of film, it's not that people are interchangeable, but you can kind of know you're going to be able to deliver to a funder what you say. Mm-hmm. With the film I'm making with Jeannie, that's more of a kind of singular observational story where you have to work with specific people because they're involved in that story.
Yeah.
Has to happen in a particular place. You have no control over the timeline. You have no control over the end point. And so there's a bit more of a gamble there. Yeah. But then you know you're going to end up with a film with really interesting people on screen. You know you're filming with people who were engaged in a kind of battle for their livelihoods.
Mm.
So something interesting is going to come out of that, even if you have to ultimately stop filming before everything was totally resolved.
I was going to say, with that kind of project, who calls time, you know?
It depends on what's going on in your life, really. That's the sort of banal answer that, like, sometimes you, with a documentary, you make it for years and you wait for it to get to an end point that it's going to resolve in.
Mm.
Sometimes you just have to stop filming because you have to move on to another project. And if you've got to a point that feels like an acceptable end point where you're getting the ideas across, you've got enough of a story, then sometimes you have to call time. Also, sometimes you are working for a broadcaster who has given you a very specific date to deliver to them, or there's a hook that you want it to be released at cinemas to hit, or there's a festival you want to hit. And sometimes that dictates things. Like, kind of depends who's funding it. And unfortunately, it's hard to get funding for documentaries.
Hmm.
And that difficulty in getting funding means that you often don't have someone calling the shots. And that's when you can just end up filming forever.
Yeah,
it can actually
be
quite helpful to have a commissioner who is bashing you over the head and telling you you have to hit a deadline, because then you sort of have to finish the film.
Yeah. I've interviewed Sarah Moses, who's a producer of documentaries.
Yeah,
and
I know Sarah, yeah.
And one of her things is that, well, a main thing about what she does is about the impact of her documentary as much as it is about the potential profitability. And in a way, and what I learned from her was, you know, that some of the funds out there for documentaries are not even looking to profit from it in a traditional way that an investor in film might look at the commercial potential. They're going, how much will this money help reach an audience we haven't reached yet with the message about, you know, I mean, one of the ones was about elderly people playing ping pong, and it was about promoting the idea of healthy activities for the elderly, not just, you know, letting them sit in chairs, you know, that kind of thing. And suddenly that suddenly has a big impact in terms of promoting, you know, fitness and health with people over the age of 80, which is not a normal thing.
Yeah. I mean, Sarah's really pioneered a lot of that stuff. And she used to work at the Doc Society, and the Doc Society have been real thought leaders in this country in bringing that idea of documentary impact, which sort of originated in the USA. They've really brought it over to these shores. And I think it's really important to have that audience strategy right from the start of making a film, to think about who you imagine sitting in a cinema or, you know, switching on their laptop to watch. Funders ask for that now anyway, but it's not just a tick box exercise. I think it affects the way that you make the film.
Yeah.
To imagine that range of people who are going to sit down and watch it, it's really important. And to think about the impact it's going to have on their lives. And not every film is a social impact documentary. I think it's totally fine for documentaries to be made that are not going to change the world and are just beautiful works of art. Like documentary is just the kind of, you know, put the work out there and you get the currency exchange of a measurable social change. Like that's not really how the world works, and it shouldn't work like that because these are works of art we're talking about, just like any film. But still, I think documentary is a better place than almost than any other film genre to really change hearts and minds. And that is the way a lot of audiences watch documentaries. They watch them to be informed and for it to change their lives. And so I'm really engaged with and invested in that kind of thing. And another of the films that I am working on, this time as an exec producer, it's a film called Our Land, directed by Orban Wallace, which is about the right to roam movement and the demand for access to the countryside and land that is shut off to us at the moment. And that is going to be a very impact-led documentary.
I imagine,
that to feed into the discussion and the debate around what level of right to roam we should have, but also to bring opposing people together. So we want to bring together right to roam activists, landowners, travelers, people who live in the countryside, and try and get a discussion going that crosses over like divided identities. And I really think documentary can do that because it's sort of a safe space sitting in the cinema watching a film to then have a moderated debate afterwards.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously documentary is always still governed by whichever way it points the camera. If it points it one way, it can't point at the other, can it? I remember a brilliant John Pilger one where he literally did the deconstruction of how the news was portraying a certain conflict in Central America. And then he showed you the same situation, but from a different angle, and it completely changed your perspective of it. It was really sort of clever use of documentary filmmaking. And essentially what you're saying, I mean, you're right, there isn't a need for every documentary to sort of hit everyone in the heart and change their mind. There was Frightfest, which is, you know, a festival known for horror films. One of its successful films this year, judging by, you know, word of mouth, will be a documentary called Mancunian Man. Now, you may have guessed from my accent, I'm from Manchester. And it's about a filmmaker from the 80s called Cliff Twemlow, who made a couple of films and then tried to make a whole lot more that never really led to much success. But somebody's gone and looked into the story of him and his decade of trying to make movies. And in a weird way, the story reveals that he was a pioneer without ever having any right in a way to be a pioneer, because he was shooting straight onto video because that was the accessible medium that meant there was no barrier to making it. And that's the kind of thing that later on you think of, like Dogma and all those kind of movements that happened, where that was billed as being why they were important. He was ignored for doing the same thing. And being from Manchester, to watch a documentary like that and realize you knew nothing about him, and yet here's somebody just took the time to tell a story of someone who culturally is very important, that idea of social history in a very minutiae way can become much bigger once you see it in a bit, once you see other people who've been affected by it and talking about it with fondness, you realize, wow, this man's just force of nature to want to get a film made is a story worth telling, that he did that and he impacted on like hundreds of people's lives. Even if most of the films never made it anywhere near even VHS, let alone a cinema.
Yeah, there's a really cool strand that's always been around, but particularly intensified in the last few years, of documentaries about film culture and about the act of making films, watching films. There was this amazing film, A Bunch of Amateurs, which was doing the rounds last year, Kim Hopkins' film about film society in Bradford. And I think that's really lovely. I think documentaries that celebrate film culture are really, you know, really special, as well as Maverick. I haven't seen that film, but kind of that sort of Maverick creator working on their own. I think that's great.
But I guess it's a bit like I don't know if you remember the exhibition Jeremy Deller did about Folk Archive, where he went and basically documented through an art gallery exhibition all the little culture things that were happening that you wouldn't get as big culture in terms of how we describe what's happening in Britain, but then you put it in an art gallery, suddenly you're shining a light
Yeah, I mean, I'm a massive fan of Della. Like, Della's my favorite artist, which he's a lot of people's favorite artists. And I was actually listening to an interview with him last night because he was on Private Passions, which is a Radio 3 show. And I was listening to the podcast a bit. And he was talking about when he won the Turner Prize and how he sort of didn't care initially about the prize, but it was really useful because it meant that he went from this guy who was interested in these weird bits of folk culture and in brass bands and in the Miners' Strike and, like, and all of these things. And people were sort of interested, but skeptical. But then if you're the Turner Prize winning artist, everyone's like, oh yes, that's legitimate. That, you know, that's proper. That's fine. You can come in and you can show things here. And, you know, suddenly like, oh yeah, brass bands are very important because Jeremy Della, the Turner Prize winner, says they're important. And I do think like having a documentary made about something legitimizes.
Yeah, no, whoever
the filmmaker is, it makes it seem like an important part of history. And I think that's quite important.
Yeah. And I mean, and one of Jenny's, the Sound It Out, is a prime example of that. You know, literally a record shop in Teesside.
Is
put into film history by the very, you know, canon.
Yeah, and she elevated that for an international audience.
Yeah.
And that's something that's really important to me, actually, in the films that I produce. So most of the films I'm producing are set in the UK.
Mm.
There's one that's in the US, but most of them are UK stories. And with all of them, they're all based in this country. They're all based locally, but they're all aimed at an international market and an international audience, because I think it's really important that we celebrate our local places and our local stories and our local communities and give them the respect and the exposure for the rest of the world. Because like a film about Folkestone and the little communities that live here, and especially the working class communities that live here, like, they really deserve to be seen. I think we have a problem in this country with celebrating our small communities, celebrating our working class communities. Talking about people who are unfashionable, like fishermen.
Yeah.
And it's not that I think the fishermen here are like, you know, I don't romanticize them.
Yeah.
I'm vegan. I don't eat their fish.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they all voted for Brexit. I didn't vote for Brexit. But I think it's really important that we show them to the world, because otherwise you get this very strange view of the country that's all Downton Abbey and the royal family and whatever else.
Yeah, no, it's like a disease in British film that we must live somewhere in the past.
And, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And somebody's upstairs and somebody's downstairs and somebody's
a criminal. Or you get this very grim view of like council estates and everyday life. And like, I went to see Scrapper last week, shot Egan's film, which I thought was amazing. And she actually, when I was at The Guardian, my previous job, I commissioned her to do this amazing short documentary about kids' games on council estates called No Ball Games. And both of that short and with Scrapper, I just think it's really brilliant that she's making a film about where the kind of places she grew up in that's just like quite positive and fun and silly. And so again, it's not about romanticizing it. It's just about saying, like, you can show joy in this country that is about, like, everyday people having some joy. You just don't really see that. And I just think it's really important that that is an image of the country that we show to the world.
No, I totally agree. Because in a way, working class culture is often either, like you say, very shouty or very problematic. Or it's somebody who's broken out of being working class and they're now a successful footballer or a gold medalist at the Olympics. Like, there's two extremes. You've either failed or you've broken out. And the idea that hope and joy doesn't exist in a working, I grew up in North Manchester, you know, there was plenty not to do, that's for sure. You know, but it didn't stop you living.
And that's the thing that Jeremy Della does really well as well. Like, he made this documentary, Everybody in the Place, which he made a couple of years ago. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
I think it came out during lockdown on the BBC.
Okay.
It wasn't commissioned by the BBC, but it ended up going out on the BBC. And it's a documentary about the history of rave, but it's also a social history of Northern Britain in the Midlands in late 80s and early 90s. And the premise of it is that he goes into a school in inner city London. I think it's in inner city London. And he basically delivers a lecture on the history of rave and the history of social movements and struggle in the 80s and 90s in Britain. And it's illustrated by clips, like just amazing archive of raves in the late 80s. And then like clips of the miners' strike and all this other stuff to this audience of kids for whom like this is like faraway history. Like he might as well be giving them a lecture on World War One. And it's just, I mean, it really is.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's like, I know we're going to talk about some of the films, but like older films, but it really is one of the greatest documentaries ever made.
Yeah.
Because it contextualizes history in a, it makes you see history in a totally different way. It makes you see archive in a really different way. But it's got this framework of Jeremy as this guy who probably seems like he's 90 to these teenagers. Giving them some, just like getting them excited about the country that they come from, but not the like official history of the country. It's like an unofficial history of the nation that I think is really special. It's just really worth checking out, and it's really fun as well. Della really understands all this.
Cool. Well, I'm glad I brought him up. I wasn't expecting him to be such a nodal point, but yeah, no, he's fantastic, and I totally agree with you. So to wrap up on this conversation, do you want to tell us about maybe work that people can see now that you've produced, and or give us an indication of when people can see the films you've been talking about?
I used to commission documentaries for The Guardian, and if people want to Google Guardian Charlie Phillips. Mm-hmm. That's sort of his way to get to a page that basically lists all the films I was working in. You can also go to theguardian.com/documentaries. I think that link must still work. And pretty much like every documentary on there is a film that I commissioned and exec produced, maybe not a couple of the more recent ones. In terms of looking forward, the US short that I have been producing, which is a film called The Passing, will come out on The New Yorker, probably not till next year. Mm-hmm. And then three feature docs that I have mentioned will hopefully see some light in late 2024, maybe early 2025. It's very dependent on funding, so people are going to have to wait on time, but hopefully that is when they'll all be out.
Well, good. Well, look, we hope we can get the directors on then when we get to that release stage then, and we can talk to them about making it and get their point of view as well. Well, look, let's jump into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Sounds grand, but it is just about sort of identifying those films that, it's not to say about favourite films, it's as much about films that hit you or made you see the world differently, however you want to frame it, or it could just be the film that you saw with your grandma 150 times, you know? I'm not going to judge anybody for how they, you know, hold on to film memories. Just for the people who have not heard this format before who are listening in, Charlie's given me three film titles. I'll give him a prompt. We're going to do 5 minutes talking about those films. And then when the bell goes off, we'll move on to the next film. That sound like it makes sense to you, Charlie?
Oh, really? Sounds good.
First on the list is described as Britain's only decent punk rock movie and features a who's who of punk icons. Jane County, Adam Ant, Jordan, and Toya Wilcox, although I don't know whether Toya Wilcox is a punk icon. Although I'm a fan, that's not a slight on her. I'm talking about Derek Jarman's 1978. Do you want to talk about why that film's particularly important to you?
Yeah, so Jubilee is a film that I saw when I was probably like 15 or 16. Mm. I think it must have got re-released and shown probably at the Hyde Park Picture House in Leeds. I grew up in Leeds. I think I saw it there. And I mean, Derek Jarman is my favorite filmmaker of all time. Okay. Like, he is the person who most got me into films. I think he's a genius. He's totally changed my worldview. I love everything he's done.
Okay.
And what I really loved about that film and about his whole catalogue is how DIY and cut and paste it is, and how it feels like a gang of friends putting on a school play. And that is how, like, Tilda Swinton and other people he's worked with have described it, that it's got this feeling of like, let's do the show right here. And it's just throwing all of these different elements into the pot chaotically. So in Jubilee, you've got the level of Queen Elizabeth and her kind of magic royal retinue traveling through time to late 70s Britain. And I really love that. Like, I don't like the royal family, but I'm really interested in old English culture, and I'm interested in magic, and I'm interested in English mysticism. And that was a massive influence of my life. That in itself was a massive influence of being interested in that. But that layer of like, let's get a historical figure, let's take them out of time, let's bring them into a place where there's social problems. I just think that has really influenced the things that I love in the world, which are documentary. I love, you know, like social issue documentary. And I know that Jubilee isn't that, but actually, like, it's documentary style depiction of social breakdown is so present in Jubilee. Like, the way that Jarman films people doing things, like in that film, you've got like the slits basically like burning a car and then sort of hanging a woman off the car. It's a lot more jolly than it sounds. It's filmed documentary style. Like, he worked with loads of non-actors. So that, to me, like, there's so many amazing documentary elements. There's so much social commentary in there. But then you've also got this magical overview of Elizabeth coming in. And then the stuff like, you've got the record execs, you've got kind of Adam Ant and Toya Wilcox and Jordan singing and wanting to be pop stars. So you've got this sort of constructed stuff, but everything feels simultaneously artificial and really real. And I think that's very true to the punk spirit as well. Like, it's funny because apparently, like, all the punks hated it. Like, Vivian Westwood
certainly didn't like it.
About how much she hated, like, actually, like, quite a homophobic t-shirt, unfortunately, about how much she hated the film. But I mean, I love Vivian Westwood, so we can forgive her. But, like, I think it was too true to the punk ethos. I think the punks were maybe a bit threatened by how this sort of quite posh man who wasn't really part of the punk scene, like, immediately understood what it was all about. And it's just so fun, and it's just so silly, and it's just so playful, but it's also really angry, and, you know, it's really vicious. Like I mentioned about the kind of burnt out car thing, you know, and that's really vicious, and it is, it's a very, like, dark image of Britain, like, very...
I'm going to say, manages to portray a kind of near dystopia when you could argue it's just what was happening as well. It's sort of like, it is heightened, and like you say, it is constructed. But I mean, I saw it when I was maybe 9 or 10, like a, you know, like a Pink Triangle film on Channel 4. And I only saw it like 2 years ago when I got a BFI subscription. That was the second time I'd seen it. And my memory of it being a child was it terrified the living daylights out of me. Like, I've no, 'cause I couldn't comprehend the styles and the...
No, I mean, I felt like that scene as a teenager. I like it, being scared of it is absolutely the right thing to say. You know, like, I mean, like the scene where Jordan comes out dressed as Britannia and does this sort of operatic version of Rule Britannia. And, you know, yeah, it's just like amazing image of the country.
No, it is. I think, you know, and it's, you could argue it's a bit ham-fisted in some senses. And, but it's critical of punk, it's critical of the patriarchy, and it's critical of the class system, and it doesn't pull its punches in what it's saying, and it doesn't pretend to try and do it subtly either, you know, and I think that's kind of, I imagine that was probably what narked a lot of the, and it's weird, the idea of a punk establishment saying that's not punk, You know, it's like there's no irony to that, is there?
No, no, exactly.
There's a complete lack of self-awareness of to say, well, you're not punk, we are punk.
It's against the whole spirit.
And what, and just before we go on to the next one, also the idea of, like you say, of the sort of almost like amateurish setup, design and production design of thing, when you think that Derek Jarman came from, like, did something like the production design on The Devils, which is this amazing visual feast, which is, you know, all about the aesthetic, whereas this is about what can I do with as little, what, how creative can I be without having it to be about budget, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's just amazing.
No, I mean, I must admit, watching it as an adult, it was satisfying to see that it was still a powerful film, but it was different. I think one of the things that weirded me out, though, watching it as an adult, was where it almost did break. There's a moment where they break between two buildings, and I can see real, it's almost like you can see real London. They're obviously just doing guerrilla filming.
That's what I mean about the sort of documentary style of it. That clearly made the whole film sort of on the hoof.
Mm.
And I really like that. And you can see the workings behind it. I like that.
Brilliant. Well, look, we're now going to draw our attention to one of Britain's most distinctive and original filmmakers. As far, I mean, what I read is the word visionary is often attached to his work. So that would seem relevant, given you've picked it as a film that's important to you. I'm talking about Andrew Cotting, and you've picked his film Gallivan, which is about him, his daughter, and his grandmother, I think, who went round the coast of Great Britain. And it's a documentary, so fire away. Where did you see this, and how did you find it?
Yeah, so I mean, I always say that, like, Gallivan was the single film that made me want to work in documentaries. Amazing. And I've said this to Andrew as well. And it had this massive impact on me because I'd seen documentaries on TV probably, but I'd never seen anything like this mad story of an anarchic filmmaker taking the youngest family member and the oldest family member on a road trip where they just go and they sort of talk about their family life, but really they're just meeting interesting people on the way who are doing stupid things around the coast of Britain, who are singing folk songs, doing folk traditions, just out there living on the coast, living their lives in this sort of picture of Britain that I suppose is on like the brink of New Labour, but still feels really old. So you're seeing these like really old people who look like they could have existed in the 40s, like Andrew's grandmother.
Yeah.
And then also the like this youth culture of the 90s. And you've got all these different people simultaneously existing, all being filmed in a lot of Super 8, some digital video, in this like amazing mashup way where like everything's collage, like Cotting's filmmaking is just incredible because it's all throw up all this stuff, see where it lands, mash it up together, reuse bits, bring in random bits of audio, bring in random bits of Andrew filming himself. And it sort of makes this like weird sense, even though it's just total chaos. And I love the way that he uses sound. I mean, that'd be mind-blowing for me because it's all snippets of different material. It's snippets of his voice, snippets of Gladys, the grandmother's voice, snippets of Eden, who is kind of non-vocal, so kind of her like squeaks and sounds mixed in with people's songs and thoughts. And it's just crazy, but it really works. And it's also really profound as well, because it is Gladys and Eden getting to know each other in a way that would have been impossible had Andrew not taken them on a road trip.
Yeah.
And their lives are totally different. Like, Eden has a disability, Gladys is sort of old and forgetful, but they understand each other just by having to be on the road together. And it's just like a very English road movie as well. Like, nothing that happens apart from, I think, like at one point, Andrew is filming out the window and then of the van they're traveling in and falls off and like breaks his ankle or breaks his arm. I can't remember. And that's like about as dramatic as it.
I mean, I get the impression then that, because it's not one I've seen, I get the impression then that it's Andrew in a way making a film like this is a kind of always on artist. He's not starting a film and finishing a film.
No, this is his life. You feel like they would have been doing this road trip anyway.
Yeah, and he just had
a camera with. And it gets me excited that there was a time when this kind of filmmaking got supported by the BFI and other people, where you could just give this crazy artist some money to go off and document what they would be doing anyway. But it's also just a brilliant picture of the nation as well. And it's all observational filmmaking, but spliced together in the most chaotic way.
What's the power, do you think, of that idea of like the incongruous audio with the visual you see and say, what does, you know,
I think it's like the best documentaries. I think it captures real life, but it captures that like audio and visual overwhelm that I think you get at the seaside. Like, I live by the sea. I'll just finish this thought.
Yeah, no, please do.
And it captures that like overwhelming feeling that you get on a busy day at the seaside, where you're getting the sights and the sounds and everything's coming together. But I also think that that is how everyday life feels. I think it can feel quite overwhelming.
Yeah, that's
what he captures.
And I think in its own way that, from a person who writes scripts like I do, where you're constantly having to invent conflict to make so it can be dramatic, the idea of just filming what you see and then pulling that together into making something that isn't necessarily, there's no drama to it. It's just, but it's still got, there's still something to see. And I guess the longer we get from 96, the more it becomes that social history document as well, because it's a snapshot, like you say.
No, it's now a picture of a time, and it's also a picture of a family who are a lot older now as well. So it's interesting hearing Andrew talk about the film now and about the impact it had on all of their lives.
God, must have done. And without once you point a camera at someone, there's always going to be an element of performance, even if they're going, I don't care if you point a camera at me.
So that
brings its own uniqueness to what's happening while you're on the journey.
Yeah, totally.
Well, sir, we're on to your final choice. Cool. And we're now entering the world of American production now. David Lynch's fractured fantasy, Lost Highway. Do you want to talk about where this fits in your film-loving life?
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, like, David Lynch is quite a long way from documentary.
Yeah.
And from documentary-style filmmaking. But I have loved his work since I was a teenager. I think Eraserhead was probably the first of his films that I saw, but I really clearly remember watching Lost Highway when a friend of mine was babysitting in this sort of big old house in Leeds.
Yeah.
And I went to keep him company, and we'd got the VHS, because it was 1997, so it was VHS.
Indeed.
Of Lost Highway. And when we started watching the film, it was light. And then the light fell as we were watching the film, and it got darker and darker around us.
Oh, wow.
And I just really clearly remember the, like, you know, all the stuff with the guy with the sort of really white face who says, like, your house right now, and all the classic stuff. Like, I remember, like, my friend Anthony was sitting in front of me in a chair, and I just remember him turning around and me being absolutely terrified that his face would be painted white. And that, you know, I was into Lynch before that film, but then I was really into him after that, because that world building that he does and that idea that there's this whole other world that we don't know and we don't understand that is going on just through the, you know, through the wall or through the window, and at any moment something absolutely terrifying could happen, and that there could be an alternative you somewhere else. Like, I just love all of those ideas. I just love the way that he can conjure evil and uncertainty and anxiety And like, I think people need, like, people just need to feel really excited that we live in a time when David Lynch is making work.
I mean, listening to him, when you hear him talk about his practice, and certainly when he's talking about film, like the idea that he's quite comfortable creating a dreamscape as opposed to a narrative is terrifying to me as a writer, because I'm not that confident. But when you hear him talk about it, sounds dead easy. He's not highfalutin or anything. He's just saying that, you know, when you dream, you know, the idea of when you dream, the narrative in your head can clash with something else, and it doesn't confuse you. You just go with it.
Yeah, and it's like totally, and it's like a cliche probably of filmmaking that, like, you know, it's exciting when someone puts a dream on screen, but he really does do that. And I think it is easy for him to do this because he can hold so many different visions of the world and so many different psychological states in his mind. And to me, his films like make sense. Like, obviously they're non-narrative and they're non-linear in a lot of cases, but I think they make sense in a way that I think appeals to like something really primal in us.
Yeah.
Of understanding the importance of images and myths and dreams that I think like really appeals to something deep inside us.
Well, I think we can spoil a film from 97. Do you think that Red Madison, the Bill Pullman character, is fantasizing about a better life from the point of view he's on the electric chair and he's going to die? Do you think what we're seeing is like a death dream?
I think that is something that David Lynch is teasing us with. Mm. I think he's maybe saying, oh, this would be a nice thing that would tie it all up for you and make you feel safe because everything makes sense.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's actually what's going on.
Oh, right.
I think all his films have like layers upon layers. And I think the layer there is like, here's an enticing like little package for you.
Yeah.
But like in a way, if it was tied up as nicely as that, not that it's very nice,
yeah,
there's something really discomforting in being offered this sort of perfect chocolate to eat. and that's what runs through all of his films. Like, you know, there's so many scenes that he makes of like a key and a lock, and he loves giving you that thing where an easy solution is going to come along and you can turn the lock and then everything will make sense. But that never really happens. You never get to that point of resolution with him.
I mean, also, what he does beautifully is he takes something as tropey as procedural, which is police arrive on a murder scene and are talking away about, you know, what the murder is and interrogating the suspect. And then you have a moment where Mystery Man says, you know, we've met before. No, we haven't. I'm in your house now. No, you're not. Well, call me. And suddenly you're like, whoa, the rug's been pulled. I don't know why this is happening.
Yeah, he's brilliant at undermining genre. Mm. He loves genre and he can undermine genre. And I've actually just been rewatching the first two seasons of Twin Peaks, which I've seen like a million times. Because I think it's like one of the greatest works of our time. I mean, not all of it. Some of season two is terrible, but like as a whole thing. And it's just amazing that he like took the police crime drama TV series.
Yeah.
And it totally works as a murder mystery, but it's also absolutely not about the murder in any way or form. And like that is, it's pretty cool.
Indeed. Well, look, we've reached the end of your three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Thank you very much for sharing those.
No worries. No, that was, I really enjoyed it. It's really nice talking about films.
Always is.
Yeah, but I get very excited about it.
To be fair, if it's me talking, something's gone wrong. So I'm very grateful that you were as enthusiastic as you are about these films. You're programming the Folkestone Documentary Film Festival, we're recording this on the 12th of September. When is the Folkestone Documentary Film Festival?
So the Doc Festival is October 19th to the 22nd.
Okay.
So it's over a weekend in Folkestone. Festival passes are only £30 full price or £15 concessions, which gets you access to all of the 12 programs in the festival. So it's pretty amazing value, and you get to come by the sea as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put links in the show notes and links to your Guardian documentaries you mentioned as well. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Bullet Fix podcast.
No worries. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.